From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we're at UW-Milwaukee in front of a live audience celebrating WUWM's 60th birthday in our Lake Effect On-Site series.
We'll be joined on stage by the first employee of NPR and learn all about the early days of public radio.
Then we'll hear about the early days of WUWM with a familiar voice. Former general manager Dave Edwards is here to share some of our history.
Plus, we'll speak with WUWM's newest Eric Vaughn Fellow, and it's first.
I want to see more folks that look like me telling stories that we don't always get to hear, just because sometimes those mics, those cameras aren't in those communities.
We'll learn more about journalist Eric Vaughn and the impact of the fellowship created in his honor.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Joy Powers. Thank you so much for joining us. We are in front of a live audience here on the campus of UW-Milwaukee, the birthplace of WUWM. We're celebrating 60 years on the air, and what better way to celebrate than by looking back at where it all began?
Later in the show, we'll look at the origins of WUWM as a student-run station, how it evolved into the community resource we know today, and look at one of our cornerstone programs, the Eric Vaughn Broadcast Fellowship. But we're going to start with the origins of public radio itself. And who better to talk about it than the first employee of National Public Radio, Jack Mitchell.
Jack has had a storied career in public radio. Not only was he the first employee of NPR, he was also the first producer of All Things Considered, the director of Wisconsin Public Radio, the board chair of NPR, and he is also the author of Listener Supported, The Culture and History of Public Radio. Jack, thank you so much for joining us.
Great to be here.
Now, there is a misconception that people who work at public radio stations work for NPR in D.C. I think this is something we've all encountered. But most of us work for other public radio stations, and some were even founded before the public radio network was formed. Kind of going back, when do we start to see public radio emerge in the U.S.?
Well, about the 1920s. The AM radio was just being invented at that time. And a number of universities in around the country, primarily land-grant colleges, those places that had agriculture schools and home ec and practical kind of things, they saw this radio as a way to extend that kind of mission. And so places like WHA in Madison, WOI in Ames, Iowa, WOSU in Ohio State University, and about 20 others, went on the air with very practical, down-to-earth programming that helped people live their lives in a very practical way.
So you mentioned one station in Madison. How does public radio begin to take shape here in Wisconsin overall?
Well, it really came down to in-school programming. Remember, this was the 1920s and 30s. It was mostly one-room schoolhouses across the state. There was no music teacher. There was no science teacher. There was one person who had to juggle all these kids. And so the folks at the university who really were not that interested in K-12 education, really, but it was a way to justify building a state network that would reach schools all over the state. And so there were programs like Let's Sing, the science program. There were others that were, there was a one called Let's Draw, which was kind of great. It was a radio show. And they had, the professor would say, and it was actually, they tried to move it to TV and it didn't work, because he would say, imagine you're feeling sad. Draw that. Okay. And they did. And then they had to send their drawings back to the university. They were graded, commented on, and sent back. You do it on TV, and they would show you a picture of somebody sad, when the kids would copy it. So the Let's Draw, this was kind of the thing. This was a very innovative group that they had that did the School of the Air programs. And it was the backbone of the network until television came along, when it all moved over to TV, and radio had to find something else to do. And what it was basically was public radio.
Now, we mentioned the Public Radio Network. That was formed in 1970 after Lyndon B. Johnson signed the Public Broadcasting Act. What were you doing at this time?
Well, actually, I was a graduate student at the University of Illinois when they signed the act. But it was in 67 that they signed it in 67, but it took 3 years to get NPR's act together. PBS started right away. They knew what they were doing. Radio really didn't. And so it took 3 years. And so what they did was sent me to London. And I worked at the BBC for a year to see how do you do radio for public service. And when I came back, they had finally gotten it together. And I ended up, I was the first employee because that was part of the deal when I went to London, that I'd come back and be part of the new organization, except the new organization didn't work. It wasn't there yet. So for about a month, I sat in an office and I was NPR. And then finally a president, they got a president and they got other folks came in and it was the way we went. But that was the beginning. And it was not, you know, radio was not supposed to be part of the Public Broadcasting Act. It was public television was drove this thing. And they knew exactly what they wanted. They wanted a PBS, and they wanted WGBH to be so the center of the whole thing, and it is now. And so they had their thing together. A few radio managers said, no way, we're not going to be left out of this thing. And as a result, they lobbied. It did some underhanded deals, which I'm not going to go into because it's not very seemly. But they managed to get one senator to say, wouldn't it be more accurate to call this public broadcasting instead of public television? It was supposed to be the Public Television Act. It was supposed to be the Corporation for Public Television. And yeah, they said, yeah, it makes sense. So they did. And radio was entitled then to 10% of the money that went to television. Television got 90%, radio would get 10. TV hated the idea. Yeah, they were furious. They didn't forgive us for years. But they kind of had to learn to accept it eventually.
So who were you working with, you know, when you did your first turn at the BBC and coming back here to kind of establish NPR, and what were some of the other roadblocks in creating this national system?
Well, the main thing was we didn't know what we wanted to do. And the board didn't quite know what to do. The president came from television, and he sort of wanted to do television on radio. There's a guy named Bill Simmering, who actually was born in Madison, worked at WHA, was a high school counselor. But he loved radio, and he wrote lots of think pieces about the philosophy and how we can change the world if we only had great radio. And he became the first program director, and wonderful man, still alive. He must be about 90 now, lives in Philadelphia, and very visionary, not very practical, but very had great ideals, and it inspired a lot of people, including me.
How would you describe the atmosphere in the early days of NPR?
Amateur. We were not very good. One of Seymour's nice things or awful things is that he didn't think that radio experience qualified you to be working at NPR. In fact, if you had experience, you probably shouldn't be there because it's the wrong experience because you wanted to create something brand new. So he hired people kind of on the basis of personality. I remember one woman who had no knowledge of any of this, but she was very artistic and sensitive, and she said some interesting things. She didn't know how to edit tape, and she was one of our producers. We only had five reporters, as I recall, and five producers on. And that's when I was producing All Things Considered. That was my staff. We had five producers, five reporters, 90 minutes a day to fill, and it was a struggle. But there was so much energy and enthusiasm that people worked 12, 14 hours a day. But it was not sustainable. They had to build that up, And we had a couple of very talented people. Susan Sandberg has to be mentioned because she was not only great on the air, she was just a dynamo as a human being and understood in her gut what it ought to be. She understood Siemering better than Siemering did and managed to pull it out and get people to talk and to reveal themselves and make it truly human. And she had it exactly. So the first thing I did was to make her host of the show. And it was the president did not like that idea because she didn't sound like public television. But it was the right thing to do. And Siemering backed it all the way. And that really defined the program. A lot of people don't like Kerr sound. And, you know, frankly, it's a little off-putting sometimes if you don't like Bronx accents. But she had that basic human curiosity. She just demanded that people listen and that they talk to her and reveal themselves. And she's very, very smart. She was great. That was key. Siemering and Sandberg were the two.
Of course, All Things Considered is a program that we're all familiar with. We almost take it for granted because it's such a staple in the daily programming. Can you talk about what it looked like format-wise at first compared to what we hear today?
Yeah. Well, it was 90 minutes, and some people thought it should be an hour. Some people thought it should be 2 hours, and in the great public radio tradition, we compromised. So it was 90 minutes at 5 o'clock Eastern Time, 4 o'clock Central, and it was not as newsy as it is now. It was we started the show with some news-related pieces, and it got softer as it went through that half hour. Second, the 6 o'clock hour started with newsy again, then softer. The middle part of the program, the half hour that started at 5:30 Eastern, was all features. That was partly because Susan Sandberg only worked half time. And she had to get home for dinner. She had a husband and a child, and she had to get home for dinner by 6 o'clock. So she left at 5:30. And the half hour, that feature half hour, was taped in advance. And then introduced a couple of pieces for this last half hour, but her co-host was Mike Waters. He handled it, and then they just slipped in her voice a few times. But she was home cooking dinner. And that was one of the great things about it. She was so human. And she worried about cooking dinner for her family.
So this is a bit of a left turn, but this year there have been a lot of developments raising concerns about the future of funding for public broadcasting. The FCC announced an investigation into the role of sponsorship in public media. There's a planned congressional hearing and ongoing efforts to reduce or eliminate funding for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. How do these threats compare to what we've seen historically? And I'm wondering if you could also just clarify kind of funding for public radio.
Yeah, well, of course, the biggest crisis came under Richard Nixon because he wanted to just eliminate the whole thing. Not radio. He didn't know radio existed. I mean, nobody knew we existed. We were irrelevant until probably the 1980 or so when Morning Edition came on the air. Then we became kind of important. But anyway, he did try to eliminate funding for television, which would have meant radio would have gone too. So that was the most serious crisis. Newt Gingrich went after us in 96, I think it was. But by then we were too big and important and we had too many people that liked us. And so, no congressman with any brains would vote against us. So it was not as if this is the first time it's happened. I think the really scary thing, though, is that for the first time, listenership is down. And we are not as strong as we were. And fundraising at a lot of stations is down. And so when Gingrich attacked us in 96, we were growing and we were dynamic. It was really, every year the audiences were up and the fundraising was up. So we were strong. And now we're a little bit more vulnerable. because there are alternatives. People can listen to podcasts. There are other ways to get good information, other than public radio. And so prior to, the last 15 years or so, we had it all. And then nowhere else could you go to get anything intelligent on the radio. Well, now there are other places. And that's worries me, actually, more than what any of the political stuff, because we're vulnerable. We don't have that monopoly anymore.
Given all the trial and error and ups and downs throughout your career, why have you chosen to dedicate so much of your life to public radio?
What else am I going to do? I liked radio when I was a little kid. I used to, let's pretend, I'm dating myself, but in the 1940s and 50s, radio was on all the time in our house, and I loved it, and I wanted to do it. And then when I realized there was a thing called public radio coming on the scene, I said, I can not only play the radio, but do something that's intelligent and meaningful and journalistically sound. This is heaven. And so I made up my mind that I knew that there was this discussion that maybe public radio would get into the Public Television Act. And so I started cultivating the people that were going to build it, I hoped, and managed to get myself sent to London, and there it went.
Well, Jack Mitchell, you're a man of many titles, the first employee of NPR, first producer of All Things Considered, former director of Wisconsin Public Radio, and the author of Listener-Supported, The Culture and History of Public Radio. Jack, thank you so much for joining us here on Like Effect
today. Well,
thanks
for asking me. This is an honor.
Coming up, we are going to have a familiar voice here on stage. Former general manager Dave Edwards is here to talk all about the history of WUWM.
That's next on Lake Effect. Stay tuned. You're listening to 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Joy Powers. On September 28th, 1964, WUWM went on air for the very first time. The station began as a service with UW-Milwaukee's Instructional Communications Center, with a goal to provide mass communications majors and other students practical training in broadcast journalism.
At the time, WUWM was run primarily by volunteer students and Dr. Ruane Hill, the director of the ICC. Under Dr. Hill and the student program director, Joanne Zutz's guidance, a team of students wrote, produced, and directed 76% of the shows on the air. The programming ranged from news and music, correspondence courses, and foreign language cultural programs.
In July of 1970, WUWM was designated as a charter affiliate member station, forming the new public radio network. By 1976, it had become a full-scale radio station, providing public affairs and information to the entire Milwaukee community.
Our next guest started working at WUWM in early 1977 when he became the program news director. He was later named general manager in 1985 and led the station for more than four decades. Dave Edwards, welcome back to Lake Effect. Good to see you.
Hey, great to be here.
So, Dave, what did you think of WUWM before you started there? Was there a reputation for the station in those early years before you joined?
Well, remember when Jack said that NPR was, the programming was, what did you say, pitiful, not engaging? It was worse at WUWM. I mean, imagine the scenario, right? I mean, like any student on campus who wanted to be on the radio and do whatever they want, they were welcomed, And so as a result, you had this, as my mother used to call it, a hodgepodge of anything and everything, from classical music to hard rock to blues to poetry. I mean, you name it. And of course, it always varied by the quality of the host. And if a host had an exam, they wouldn't show up, so then that program wouldn't air. So the reputation of WUWM is really non-existent. And you have to remember that at the time, literally the station couldn't be heard beyond a few blocks around the campus. So, from the university's point of view, it was doing no damage, and at best, it was maybe training some students. And it did. I mean, there were a lot of people whose careers were launched at WUWM. The great Bob Reitman is a classic example of that. Reitman started out reading poetry on WUWM. And a lot of people kind of went through that process and then went on to bigger and better things. So, its beginnings were humble at best.
So what was your background and what drew you to then come to our little humble station at the beginning there?
Desperation. After graduating from UWM, I worked in commercial radio for a couple of radio stations. The last one being, at the time it was WRIT AM 1340, which was a rock and roll station, and then later became an all-news radio station. And I was fortunate to be a reporter and anchor there. And the station we knew was going to be sold. We knew the format was going to change. So your pal Dave started sending resumes and tapes everywhere around the country. And in fact, little known trivia, Jack Mitchell did not hire me because one of those tapes went to Wisconsin Public Radio, and he hired this guy who went like nowhere, a guy named Tom Clark. I don't know if you've ever... Tom actually became a very good friend of mine. But I was always fascinated because I actually heard the very first All Things Considered. And at that moment, I realized that there was more to radio than just, covering school boards and doing all that kind of thing. So I wanted to be in public radio. And the radio station at the time, the general manager wanted to build a newsroom, starting with students, training those students to be real journalists, and then gradually hire a full-time staff. So I was brought on ostensibly to start a news department.
So set the scene for us. What did the station look like at that time? Where was it on campus?
Like a lot of public radio stations, it started in the basement of a building that was totally ignored and totally forgotten about. And that spoke to its priority at most universities. And so WUWM was in a basement in the Fine Arts Music Building and really had no decent facilities. I mean, the idea of soundproofing a studio was totally foreign. It was just in a former classroom with a door and some equipment, and that was pretty much radio.
Was it a fully professional station at the time? Was it still partly student-run?
For many years, it was very heavily dependent on students. I really ran the newsroom. I was the only full-time person in the newsroom for quite a while. We had a couple of engineers. We had a couple of other people who kind of handled the administrative functions of the station, but still most of the on-air was done by students. The university at some point began to realize that NPR was growing and it was becoming successful nationwide. And the decision was made that if UW-Milwaukee wanted to be an NPR station, it would have to move away from being totally dependent on students. So throughout its development, students have always played a very important role at WUWM. But I would say that at some point in the 80s, the proportion changed, and the station began hiring more and more full-time professionals who would still work with students, but there weren't as many students in terms of a ratio.
Right, and it was by 1976 that WUWM became that fully staffed news radio station. And I imagine it was a bit of a shakeup, especially for students who thought they could, come and use it as a learning experience. So can you talk about that transition and how that change was received by the campus community, by listeners?
Well, I think the listeners appreciated it because now there was a service that they could count on, and it wasn't just students pretending that they were on the radio. Obviously, not all students were happy because now they were being given instruction on what to do, and their work was being edited, as opposed to just go on the radio and do anything that they wanted to do. But so there was a transition, but the community embraced it.
How did you make sure that you continued to be a community resource while navigating this change of programming?
Well, I think the change is what allowed us to become more of a community resource, because all of a sudden we were producing news content that was winning awards, that was getting attention. One of the greatest thrills I'll still remember is when we did a series on something, and like a week later, the Milwaukee Journal basically did that series. So we knew that people were listening.
And with that growth comes some new homes, and our station has had a total of 3 homes so far. So starting here on campus, as we mentioned, but then in 1994, a capital campaign began to move off campus. Can you talk about, you know, what was the point where you're like, we gotta move? Why was it a need?
Well, we figured we had to move if we were really going to build out our programming, because the predecessor's show for Lake Effect was really almost the impetus for us deciding we had to get off campus, because there was no parking. And if we wanted to have guests come on a radio show, they had to have a place to park, and that was next to impossible to do. That plus the fact that we were out of space, the staff had been growing, and the university was also out of space, and there was really no opportunity for us to expand on campus. So we started a campaign, and we ended up moving to the Plankinton building in downtown Milwaukee, which was our first venture off campus.
It always comes down to parking. That's what I've learned about public radio.
It does.
Really comes down to parking. So from the basement of a campus building, we did move to, as you mentioned, another basement.
Yes.
It was another basement.
Yes.
In a beautiful building. But,
right.
What was that space like?
It was bigger. It was a lot bigger than what we had on campus. But it did have its shortcomings, like rats. Because if you know the Grand Avenue building, it's right along the river. And river is, you know, that's where rats like. And occasionally they would sneak into the building. And so we had some pets over the years. We also had some flooding that occurred. So we knew that was not going to be our long-term home. But it was great for a while, but it allowed us to kind of re-envision the kind of space that we would really need for the long term, which eventually took us to Chase Tower, where the radio station is located now.
Now, with all of our homes here, the constant has remained that we are licensed through UWM. So what to you has been the importance of the station being tied to the university here?
Oh, there's so many benefits. I mean, I think that, you know, the core of public radio, as Jack was mentioning in its very first, the beginnings of public radio, have always been tied to educational institutions. And we benefited in so many different ways. And I think the station still benefits to be administratively housed within a university. Just because of the resources that the university brings, the faculty members that we're able to bring on the air, and actually the credibility that I think the radio station has by having those call letters, WUWM.
Now, this is a very big question.
Okay.
As you look at the last 60 years of the station, and especially your time at the station, what would you say you're most proud of?
The people that I have gotten to work with over the time, and the relationships that we all built within the community. I mean, it boggles my mind that you know, the station has become an integral part in so many lives that people would come out here, for example, to see this show, and the station has developed the importance it has in the community. That to me is the most amazing thing. But I also think of the many talented people who have worked for WUWM all throughout its history. I mean, the talented people who work in the newsroom, the people who've worked on Lake Effect and its predecessor. I think it's the people that have been totally amazing who have gravitated to public radio.
Dave Edwards was the general manager for WUWM for more than 40 years. Dave, thanks so much for being here. It was a pleasure.
It's my pleasure.
Coming up, we will be joined by our newest Eric Von Fellow and our oldest Eric Von Fellow. We'll learn all about what that fellowship has done for young journalists here in Milwaukee. That's coming up next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Eric Von was a journalist and commentator who worked in radio for more than 25 years here in Milwaukee. His work engaged our community in conversations about the issues that matter to Milwaukeeans.
Von worked with WNOV and other commercial radio stations, and he spent his last years working with WUWM and 371 Productions on the Precious Lives Project, a two-year, 100-part weekly radio series about gun violence and young people in the Milwaukee area. He passed away in 2016 at the age of 58.
A year later, WUWM established the Eric Von Broadcast Fellowship to honor Von's memory by helping the next generation of journalists develop their craft and carry on his legacy.
We're joined now by Von's wife, Faith Colas. She's the creator of the fellowship and a WUWM advisory board member. We're also joined by our first ever Von Fellow and WUWM's race and ethnicity reporter, Taryn Powell, as well as our current fellow, Maria Peralta Arellano. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Joy.
Thank you.
Faith, can you tell us a bit about Eric, his career, and just his life?
Sure. Well, Eric was born and raised in Washington, D.C. And he attended school at Howard University. He worked for Kathy Hughes. Folks have been talking about, you know, how people started in radio. Eric was a disc jockey. He played music, and people in his family thought that was fitting for him because you could never hear his voice on the air. But he spent 25 years talking. He worked for Kathy Hughes, an African-American pioneer in black radio, as her business manager, and heard about a conference somewhere in the United States where Willie Davis was looking for people for radio stations that he had opened up. And one, of course, here in Milwaukee, and he met Willie Davis at one of those radio conferences and said, I'm the guy pretty much that you're looking for, and got a chance to do like music and talk at the same time at one of Willie Davis's radio stations. The last one he worked with here in Milwaukee was 1290 before coming to WNOV and then eventually WUWM.
And can you share a bit more about, you know, his personality? I remember his like big but quiet presence at the station, you know, and it was always such a nice time when Eric was there. But can you share just what stood out to you about him?
His dry humor. It was dark and dry and quick. He was very quick-witted. And I think that his love for just information, quiet as it's kept, Eric is really a nerd. I mean, you know, Mayor Barrett always talked about how classy he dressed, you know, and how intelligent he was and how he could hold a conversation and bring people of all backgrounds together for the whole point of resolution, right, in conversation. But Eric was a nerd. Oh my God. He read everything. I mean, the back of a cereal box, you know, bubblegum wrappers, you know, whatever. And he talked all the time. Had he lived to see Uber, he'd have been an Uber driver. Because he loved driving and he loved talking and he loved meeting people. He could, you know, start a conversation with anyone, anywhere. And when we would be in the grocery store, if it was a 10-minute grocery store trip, it turned into an hour and 10 minutes. People would want to pick up where he left off or where they left off, listening to him on the air and have a conversation with him, and I would just take the buggy and just keep on going. You know, I was doing television at the time, and you know, and he was doing radio, so between the two of us, it took a little time to get through our normal life activities. He loved golf. When we met, he told me he had two vices: poker and golf. And he was good at both of them. Little did I know, but I learned later on, he was also a professional bowler. So bowler, professional golfer, and professional poker player.
Thanks for sharing more about him. So can you share when the idea for this fellowship began?
Well, you know, I have to share credit, and it wasn't Faith's idea. It really was a WUWM idea. And during the first week or so after Eric's death, after he passed away, I got a call from Michelle and Dave Edwards, the man who really started it all, you know, bringing everyone together and having this conversation about, we want to remember Eric. We want to do something that speaks to his legacy. And we were thinking about a fellowship where a college graduate would apply for it, and it would be a paid fellowship for them to learn the career around public radio as a reporter.
Taryn, how did you first hear about the fellowship? Were you familiar with Eric's work before you applied?
So I was not familiar with Eric's work before I applied. And also learning new information that he was a professional bowler.
Yeah, right?
I was also a bowler.
Get out.
From like the age of 9 through high school.
Get out.
Like a whole league. So I wish we could have bowled together. But back to the question. I was not familiar with his work. So I was actually working at another TV news station in Milwaukee. They shall remain nameless. But yeah, I actually had a former professor from Marquette send me that job listing, and I took one radio course with her, and her name was Barb Volbrecht, and we were like besties in any journalism class I had with her, like, you know how you do the icebreakers, and you are partnered up with classmates. I was always her partner. I don't know how it worked out like that, but yeah, so we had that one radio course. I think that was probably my junior year at Marquette. And, you know, I was looking at the listing, and I'm like, I don't know anything about radio, but what have I got to lose? You know, just send out all the applications after graduation. Somebody's bound to call you back. So, yeah, I just really took a chance there, and it worked out. And I've been here for almost 7.5 years now. And yeah, time flies when you're having fun. But yeah, I knew nothing of radio. I was not a public radio listener. Like, I completely new to NPR. You know, during the application process, I of course would look up who Eric Vaughn was, as you should. If there's a fellowship named after someone, you should see what they did in the community. And I came across the Precious Lives series, and I feel like that was something that resonated with me because I'm originally from Chicago, and gun violence has been an issue that it's always been around. You know, when I was growing up, just seeing different things happening in the city affected my family. So the issue was just, you know, near and dear to my heart. So I think coming into the job, knowing that was one part of his job, you know, just highlighting stories of especially young people who are affected by gun violence. I think we had a connection there that I feel like, you know, we were on the same page in terms of wanting to share people's stories about how they're impacted by something like that. So I think it was meant to be, you know.
So Taryn, you were the first fellow in the program, and you really helped shape what the fellowship became. But do you recall some of those growing pains of the program in that first year, having, you know, for one, not been familiar with public radio, but also this is the first year of a fellowship. So I'm sure, like, as a station, we were figuring that out, too.
Yeah, I mean, I think there was a lot for me just, like, am I going to do this right? You know, being new to the radio world, I feel like I paid probably too much attention to like trying to be perfect essentially at this job. And, you know, am I doing this right? What's the right story? What's the right question? I was in my head a lot. And yeah, being the first and wanting to, you know, make sure that you honor a legacy like Eric Bond's, I probably put more pressure on myself than I needed to. But, you know, having the support of the station and also from the community, from people who knew Eric, I think that helped me. But, yeah, just being too much in my head, I think, was an issue I had early on. And just wanting to do everything, but also like knowing that you can't do everything. You know, you don't want to say no when you're new at a job. You know, you want to say, yes, I'll do this project. Yes, I'll participate in this. It's not too much. I'm not overwhelmed, you know. But yeah, I just appreciated that I had the support of the station, people in the community. Faith always, you know, being the supportive person she is, definitely like a second mom to me, so, or maybe like third or fourth. A lot of people love me. I got a lot of mamas. So, yeah, I just, it was easier having people, you know, not throwing you to the wolves. Like, we have your back should you need it, you know.
Well, and with this idea of support, of course, the fellowship has changed so much during your time at the station, but you've been a big part of that change. You're really a mentor now for the fellows. How do you see your role as a mentor?
Yeah, it's really crazy to have gone from, you know, being that fellow and now helping, you know, usher in new journalists into this industry. I'm still in disbelief, honestly, because I'm like, me, I don't know what I'm doing. I'm winging all this. But I definitely see the role, for one, of course, like giving you the, you know, ones and twos of how this stuff goes, right? But I think it's also important to have somebody who supports you outside of the job. So like if you need to take a moment to say like, I'm overwhelmed by this, or just trying to talk through the news or talk through a story, like I feel like it's important to be a cheerleader essentially, like letting, you know, the fellow know, I know you know what you're doing. I don't need to speak for you, et cetera, et cetera. But should you need somebody behind you to help you advocate for yourself, like, I'm here. I don't want to be overbearing. Like, we can draw that line to how much help you need. But I feel like I'm telling you all the time, Maria, like, if you need me, I'm here. Like, I know I'm leaving the office, but you can text me. Like, I just want to make sure.
I heard it like four times
today. Yes. Asking her how she felt about the event. How you doing? You need to talk through anything? But yeah, I just being there professionally and personally for the fellow is really important, because you, like me, new to an industry, for example, not speaking for you, but I think having somebody there to be like, you're doing okay, like you don't have to take all the assignments, you can feel free to say no, like just learning how to advocate for yourself, it's amazing to have somebody next to you, like if they need to be there for you.
So, Maria, you're our seventh Vaughn Fellow. What were your expectations coming into this?
So, I remember getting the call from Annalise, my supervisor, saying that I got the job. And I remember being so excited, I didn't say anything. And that was kind of like, that's where my head was at, where it was like, I just got a job at WWM. Like, I don't care what they throw at me. Like, I'm just excited. Like, I'm just ready to go, and I was ready to learn. So when I actually got to the station and, you know, saw the offices and met everyone from there on, I was just expecting a great learning experience. Just expecting to, you know, at anything that I need or want to learn, that it was there for me. And I think that was just like my biggest expectation going into it, is that I'm here to learn, and that's the environment that I'm in, and it's just support and learning.
How familiar were you with the program? Because it seems like, especially over the past couple of years, the kind of understanding of the fellowship has really grown.
Yeah, so I actually got to learn about the fellowship from the best person to learn about the fellowship from, and that was Faith, and the last fellow, so Nadia Kelly and Helen Ambule. So before being the Eric Vaughn Fellow, I worked for another independent media company, and my boss had put the press release for Nadia onto my desk, and she asked me if that was something that I would be interested in covering, you know, a story. So I was like, yeah, why not? So I set up the interview with Nadia, Faith, and Helen, and I came into the station, and we had our interview, and I asked them quite literally everything that I would want to know about the fellowship. And I went home, I wrote the story, I published the story, and I continued up with the fellowship. I would listen to Nadia's stories, and it was going like that for a couple of weeks where I would just pop in, listen to the work that was being produced. And I graduated from UWM last May, and one of my last classes was a audio storytelling class. And Nadia Kelly came into the class to speak to us. And that moment, I saw her walk in, she was talking to us, and that was when I knew it was like my application's going in. So yeah, I knew the newsroom, I met the newsroom, I saw the newsroom, toured it, everything. So I just kind of like warmed it up before I came in. So that was how I found out about the fellowship. So it was just like hearing it firsthand from the people who were going through it and, you know, who organized everything just led me right to it.
What have you enjoyed learning most so far? Like any standout things? Because you came in with a very open, like, I'm here to learn, let's go. So what's stood out to you about it so far?
How picky the ear is. I think you just really don't grasp how long a second is or how much a person can speak in a minute until you're actively going through the tape and seeing, you know, what the conversation looks like. My previous background was in print and online, so going into a space and immediately noting what noises could be around for me to use in a story, that wasn't first instinct. So it's a lot of rewiring of my own journalistic instincts, what to look for, what to listen for now, and also just what sounds good to people.
One of the really great things about the Eric Vaughn Fellowship is the impact it's had on raising young journalists inside of a program that does have a lot of support. It's also been very instrumental in getting more Black and brown journalists into public media, and especially here in Milwaukee. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah. That's something that was near and dear to me and Eric's heart, you know, just based on how we got into Black media, you know. No formal background, that wasn't our educational track, but it became our love. And so we oftentimes thought somehow, some way, we want to be able to usher in the next generation of broadcast journalists, print journalists, you know, either through the organizations that we belong to, just some kind of way. And it was just something that always came to us. And every time someone would see us in public, they would say, so how are you guys coming on that project? It's like in our heads and in our hearts, right? But I believe that there's a season for everything, you know. And when the call came from Dave and WUWM and friends were sending money, of course, because Eric had passed away, I used that money to help seed this fellowship because I thought, this is it. This is a way that we can remember Eric. And at the same time, when the fellows come through this program, through this fellowship, wherever they go, they are part of the most positive, great things that are happening in Milwaukee. They got it here. They got the start here in Milwaukee, wherever they go all over the world. And they're telling stories from diverse communities that make up communities wherever we are. Wherever we are, there's a diverse community in every city, in every state. And so it should, broadcast journalists in general, should reflect the communities that they represent and tell those stories about.
I guess I would just add, I think being on the other side of the fellowship and, you know, being the race and ethnicity reporter, I think definitely with the types of stories I get to tell, I just realized how much more important it is to have people of color a part of public media. I don't know the statistics of how many of us are in public media, but I know it's not enough. And like Faith said, we need to have broadcast journalists who look like the communities that they report in. So yeah, I think I just realized more and more, like, I want to see more folks that look like me telling stories that we don't always get to hear, just because sometimes those mics, those cameras aren't in those communities. While this obviously is a fellowship for people from all backgrounds, I just think especially having the opportunity to add more Black and Brown folks to public media, like, you can't get enough of that. So I'm really grateful that this exists.
Yeah, who are you telling? I'm employed. Well, I guess on my end, the person who's actively the fellow now, a big part of the reason why I got into journalism was to do exactly that. When I was growing up, Fox 6 was always on, and Kim Murphy was my first, like, journalist idol. So even then, like, the strides that diversity has made in the industry from when I was 6 years old watching Kim Murphy to now, it's big strides. Like, it's getting better. But I think programs like this build that foundation to open up the world even more to the future. And I think it's a way that media can rebuild that trust in those marginalized communities that we don't really talk about anymore. Just like historically and with nuance and context of why Black and Brown faces and voices and communities don't necessarily trust the media. So to have a fellowship that empowers us and promotes us to tell those stories and go out into our communities and not be afraid, it's a really powerful thing, and it sets up people like me and Taryn for the rest of our lives.
And the fellowship isn't just supported by the newsroom. It's not just what people are hearing on the air, but it's also supported by the community and, of course, large part thanks to you, Faith. So can you share what support has looked like for both current and former fellows?
Absolutely. Without the listeners of WUWM, the fellowship wouldn't exist. Donors, I mention the fellowship wherever I go, in whatever hall I'm in, whatever room I'm in. My friends know that every year I'm going to send you a text and say it's fellowship time. And I want the fellows to get to know other journalists and be a part of other associations. I'm grateful for folks like Helen, who she and I are members of the advisory board. And every year I host the fellow in my home. And I invite donors to come along and other journalist associations to come and meet the fellow. Last year, I was talking with, I can't remember her name, it's gonna escape me, but she was on the fundraising team of WUWM.
Is it Susan?
Susan,
yes. Susan Poplin McClurk, yeah.
And Susan and I, you know, we oftentimes talked about what the future of the fellowship looked like, and I said, you know what, I would love to have it endowed. I don't know how that can happen. I don't know when it will happen, but I'm just gonna put it out there. And so I'm a very spiritual person, and I believe that positive words, you know, have action, you know. Maybe not right away, but it does happen. And in 2024, when we were doing the meet and greet for Kobe, the fifth Vaughn Fellow, Susan said, Faith, before you wrap up, tell everyone your dream. And I said, I would love to see the fellowship with an endowment. By the end of that year, before the end of that year, Helen had reached out to me, invited me to her home, and made a $100,000 donation to the Greater Milwaukee Foundation, and now the Eric Vaughn Broadcast Fellowship Endowment exists. So I just want to put it out there. I only need 9 more of those to get to $1 million. Just saying, you know? You don't ask. So I think my grandma used to say, you know, a closed mouth doesn't get fed. So boom, there we are.
Faith Kolas is a WUWM advisory board member and the creator of the Eric Vaughn Broadcast Fellowship. Taryn Powell is our race and ethnicity reporter and our first Eric Vaughn Fellow. And Maria Peralta Arellano is WUWM's current Vaughn Fellow. Thanks to all three of you so much for joining us on Lake Effect.
Thank you.
And that wraps up today's show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of Lake Effect this week, You can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Thank you so much for joining us right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.